You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome back to the show. This is the Comedian's Comedian podcast, and today I am very excited to be speaking to Jordan Gray, who I've described in the show notes to this. Side note, I found out in the ComCom Facebook group no one reads the show notes. More on those later. But to save you the trouble of having to read the show notes, I described Jordan Gray as an exploding supernova who has just had the Edinburgh Festival that every new act dreams of. 5-star reviews across the board, sell-out shows, a transfer to the Palladium, being made an official superhero. She is just absolutely brilliant, and as I put it to her in the early part of this episode, she has pulled a complete Minchin, by which I mean turning up at Edinburgh. I mean, it wasn't her first ever show, but turning up at Edinburgh and to kind of arrive with just an absolute wealth of kind of quintuple threat gear and an angle, an incredibly rich and brilliant angle and a persona and songs and gags and an overarching concept and everything, and it's just exploded. So we are going to get right into how it feels to be in that moment right now. We're going to get a snapshot of the things that change, the things that shift, the challenges that crop up when you are when your star is in the ascendant. Also, and this was an exclusive announcement on the show, but by the time you hear it, you'll probably already know, Jordan is bringing her show, Is It a Bird, to the London Palladium on the 28th of October. So go to jordangraylive.co.uk and get your tickets for that. If you haven't seen her already, it's just going to blow your mind. It's one of those ones you see everyone on social media kind of going, I've just seen the thing. Oh my God, my life has changed. She's pulled an absolute Minchin. We will talk about the danger of believing your own hype, why she has to be an example and not just a comedian, and we also learn about some of the hard choices that await someone experiencing this moment of pure success. If you're in the Insiders Club or fancy joining up for a minimum £2 a month donation, then you can get access to 25 minutes of extras, including Jordan on her previous music career as Tall Dark Friend, What is the most heartbreaking thing to hear after a gig, a really useful breakdown of the transferable skills that a comic can bring to script writing, and we find out why she wears a jumpsuit and very deliberately isn't fabulous. She also takes me to task on my, let's be kind and say skittishness. So we'll find out about that. If you're in the Insiders Club, you can get hold of those on your podcast feed. If you are not, go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Here's Jordan Gray. Jordan Gray, welcome to the Comedians Comedian podcast at long last.
This is so cool. This really is a little dream come true. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. We only met in person very briefly because did I meet you online? Did you come and do an Infinite Sofa for us?
I did an Infinite Sofa, maybe twice, at most. And then we did a couple of lockdown Zooms together as well.
Yes, marvellous. Yeah. And you've just had the dream Edinburgh that everyone wants.
The lightning rod thing, yeah. Like, I don't know how to qualify it because I'm not supposed to jump in on that conversation, am I? I'm not supposed to say, yeah, it was great.
Yeah, you are.
I was along for the ride.
You may never get the chance again to go, yes, everything's going fantastically. So enjoy it, I think, at the time.
We are designed to have things to complain about as humans, aren't we? It's part of our evolutionary imperative. We need to have stuff to complain about, and I've got nothing to complain about. It's a really weird, my brain doesn't know what to do with itself. Every day I get a new piece of information that a year ago would have been life-changing and I would have spoken about for months, and now it's every single day and the priority list is just shuffling around. It's so strange.
It's lovely to see, as a comic and a fan of comedy, when someone who deserves massive success achieves massive success. I hadn't seen you live before I came in to see Is It a Bird? And I came on the second or third night, I think. I knew it would be great because I know you're great, but I hadn't seen you live. And it was one of those shows where within 30 seconds you go, oh, bloody hell, this is going to be amazing. And it really was, because part of me thought, oh, you're a ringer. You're a Tim Minchin, aren't you? You're turning up here pretending, oh, here's me doing my little comedy show. Whereas actually you've got years and years of professional, like, writing. I looked on, I mentioned in a review, someone said, she writes and script consults regularly for a number of UK TV production houses. I'm like, oh, what? So you're a script consultant and a kind of musical, Tim Minchin was a musical theatre director for years and never mentioned it when he was a new act, yeah, sort of thing. So you're an absolute Minchin. That's what I put to you. You bloody liar. You're not just a comedian.
That. I love that expression. Okay, I'll take that. It's like a shark. Like a comedy shark is a Minchin.
You're like a quintuple threat. Do you know what I mean?
There's something really wonderful about being along for that conversation of, you know, if you're savvy enough, you know that any success you have at that degree, or that obtuse angle of success, means you're going to be called an overnight success, regardless of how long you've been working for. Mickey Flanagan was an overnight success after 50 years of work. So it is weird experiencing that lightning rod in real time. What's really lovely is that, so you came on the early night. It was such a highlight for me. I told you over email, as well. I've not told you in person how grateful I was, but I am obviously very, very, very grateful. It's such a moment for me that you specifically showed up. You know, I got into comedy listening to Sarah Milligan's episode of ConCon Pod was the first thing I listened to. I was like, oh, okay, there's some rules and some formulas to like getting into this. I think she said something like, the idea that to be a comedian, you need to be able to play every room is absolute bullshit. Of course not. You don't need to be able to go and entertain a bunch of kids at a kids' party. Something like that. I can't remember.
that's really well put. Yeah, great.
Yeah. Regardless, yeah, so you're the first face that showed up where I was like, oh, this is getting some buzz. There's some people that I really like are quite interested in coming to see it. Then you get some good reviews, and then a review will come out. Maybe like 10 or 11 days in, we got a review that said, by the way, these other reviews are real. And that changed everything. They were like, believe the hype of the other reviews, because the other reviews could have all been flukes or bullshit. And then a review came out and said, no, that these are real. And I freaked out. I was like, oh man, this is not just exciting. It's like, it's got kudos now. People are talking about it. It's so exciting. And then old bloody McKellen showed up. Ian McKellen showed up when he was my little Magneto moment. That was very cool.
Oh yeah. Did McKellen make you an honorary X-Man?
Yeah,
that's incredible.
Because it's Magneto and the show's about superheroes, loosely, I kept picking up my mic stand and moving it towards him and going, hey, mate, come on, stop it now, you're fucking on the show. And he was loving it. And then halfway through, I was like, Ian, I made the joke about how I'm technically an X-Man because I'm an X-Man, I'm a transgender woman. And then I was like, but you're a real X-Man. So I was like, sorry, Sir Ian, if this is a bit of a ball ache. But do you mind knighting me as an honorary X-Man? And he looked a bit annoyed, like, he's like, I'm here to see some theatre. But then I realised he was acting, and he got up and he did the full Magneto at me. He stood up and he shook his arms and pointed them. And I pretended I was floating, like the iron in my blood, and he's manipulating, like in the movie. And then now we're little chums. He came backstage, he's very charming, and now he emails me to let me know how he's doing.
Oh,
it's really sweet.
Oh my God. Mate. Yeah,
it's a moment.
I mean, I was one thing I wanted to ask was, like, what is it like inside the moment of when it's going off? Like the moments when you're like, and you've already described some of those stages of like, hang on, that's a good review. That's like, what is a 5 in The Guardian on like day 2 or day 3?
Yeah, and then, day 3 The Guardian.
And then it just, like, from that, that's a pretty good front runner. Like a lot of much smaller comedy reviewers are going to feel like chumps if they go any lower than that, you know. So to be in that, to be in that kind of bubble going, hang on a minute, this is happening. Maybe it's a stupid question. Did you have that level of confidence in the show before you went up? Were you thinking, I'm planning for my breakthrough year?
Oh, I guess no, there's no sense that I'm going to be nominated for anything or reach any of those peaks. I did think I'll end the month with a diamond of a show. I was treating it like a boot camp. I was going to take what I think is a good show and turn it into a really tight, well-oiled machine and take that on tour. But we jumped a million steps when we were there. It's now, the tour was offered before the end of the second week, like full national tour. It's mad. We'll talk about all that. I'm so excited to talk to you about it because I've not been allowed, but like, I know that I've just got clearance from next door. I'm in my agent's office right now, and they were like, you can tell Stu Goldsmith it's all right.
So your that experience, were there any downsides in Edinburgh from the word go? Did you have duff nights? Did you have starfucker audiences who'd read a great review and were there because something had a great review? Or was it all...
That's a great question. We had Telegraph audiences. Love me some Telegraph. Nothing wrong with the Telegraph. It's just that they're not my natural audience. So you had a load of people showing up, I guess, with almost, if not physically, then metaphorically, arms folded, like, entertain us now. We've read that the Telegraph told us this is what we should do with our evening and spend £20 on, or whatever the ticket was. Can't remember. So earning the respect of those audiences is a completely different skill than walking into rooms full of people who know who I am. Suddenly realizing that my career is about entertaining strangers, which should have been obvious from the beginning, that changes everything. You're like, oh, it's not my fans showing up. I don't have enough fans to fill this room. It's going to be 95% strangers of all different ilks and walks of life. And it was just 100% success. It's so stupidly good. Like, everything worked out. I had a night when the ceiling leaked and we nearly had to cancel, and it was the best night of the run because suddenly I'm so fired up that this is the night when it's all going to fall apart. We went up 20 minutes late. Everybody had to wait outside in the rain. We thought, oh, they're going to leave, and as well they should. And then they all showed up one by one and funneled in like animals into an ark. And it was like, it was the best night ever. My granddad showed up one night, having read a review. He didn't ask about it. He saw a review. It was like, oh, that's my... He doesn't understand what transgenderism is. So he's like, that's my grandson is doing very well up in Edinburgh. I shall go and support. He didn't understand the show, really. Bless him. But then at the end, I don't mind spoiling it. You've seen the show. So I'm standing there nude at the end of the show, and he got up at the end, and I was like, oh, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, keep that standing ovation going for the most important man in the room. It's my granddad. He got up and he came and gave me a hug, like, in front of everyone, and then he was like, she's amazing. I was like, over the course of the run, he's like, over the show, the hour, he's sort of understood what's going on. He held his walking stick up in the air and he was like, it's the most incredible moment. And in real time, I was like, this is lovely. But it was only like walking home, I got really teary. And then I put a little post up about it. And now he's more popular than I am. It's like the little story of the run. I heard someone said, I was introducing myself to somebody the other day, and they were like, oh, you're that comedian whose granddad showed up last night and gave her a hug on stage. God. It's like, yeah, that's me. Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. It
was full of moments like that. It was a month of joy. The only downside is that there's a lot of, not to be tacky, there's now a lot of money flying around, and there was early on, and that suddenly changes the conversation for a lot of people, and things start to get not ugly, but certainly tense. Things get very tense. Whereas I'm fine. I'm a working class comedian, and I will be forever. Like, so I just want to make a massive splash. It's almost like a story of redemption rather than a story of like success and fortune. And it's definitely fame. I like the fame bit. Don't care about the fortune bit. I like the fame bit.
When you say things are getting ugly, I'm not asking you to betray any confidences, but what I assume you're alluding to is that, my first thought is like, if someone did you a favor and lent you a phone box, now they're going, oh, that phone box was a grand.
That's a really good, would be a good guess. I bought that phone box myself, and I had so much fun ripping it apart. It's made of cardboard, as you saw. On the last day, I just hulked out of it, like from the inside, rather than leave it elegantly like I'm supposed to. I just ripped it apart from the inside. It was so funny. Stuff like that, you're right. It's things that are done in good faith, and suddenly when there's money... If you'd had money at the beginning, it would have all been locked down and contracted. I'm in a good place. This is not a career disrupting. It's just like awkward conversations with people that feel a certain ownership now of a product that, again, with all the love in the world, I wrote in its entirety 100% and went up and worked my bloody arse off. Sorry for swearing on your prestigious program. Oh, bums. So there's that, but I kind of like it. It's like, it's part of the art and the part of the process, the compromise and the collaboration that extends to personal politics as well as the work. It's a weird thing to say, but I think that the social political ramifications of success is part of the artistic process rather than treating them as separate. I'm thinking about them all the time. I can't stop thinking about them when I'm on stage, that I might have upset someone by not inviting them to a show. That's all part of it for me. I don't know. It's inextricable from the art. I don't have a gear that goes now I'm going to go do some comedy. It's just, it's all the time. There's no moment of, I'm going to switch off now and have a holiday. It's all one wavy
That's
line.
Very. I remember at I did a kind of performing arts school thing in the Netherlands for 3 months, many, many years ago. And they introduced me to the concept of the body mind, which is like, we're used to dealing right. with the body and the mind as if they're separate, but actually it's the same thing. And, you know, your body affects your mind and vice versa. And I feel like that's a really interesting observation, that those two things are inextricably linked. The self as the person who got you. It reminds me of Jackie Chan sweeping the floor. Do you know what I mean? Jackie Chan sweeps the floor in his movie sets. Who told me this? Tommy Campbell told me this years ago. He sweeps the floor in his movie sets. And so I was like, Jackie, you're Jackie Chan. Why are you sweeping the floor? And he says, Jackie works, everybody works. And it's like that kind of, you know, you kind of, part of being a comedian is turning up and panicking that the mic doesn't work and trying to fix it and having sorted the poster out and all those things. That sort of holistic approach to it. Is that the sort of thing that you mean?
Yeah. And if you're running a show for 25 nights in a row and way more shows overall during the Fringe, that stuff falls by the wayside really quickly. Like, I know how a mic works. So that's one thing off the list that I'll never have to worry about. Do that 25 nights in a row. All the tiny complaints that you would normally fuss your brain with, what's the word? Like, you'd use that brain power to deal with tiny things. They're working like clockwork. And as I said, that I have nothing to complain about now, but we're designed to have stuff to complain about. So my complaints are now overarching complaints about how does my journey as a transgender person going through Fringe affect the standing of transgender people in society. I've got no small things left to worry about. So now it's only the big ones. And I would never have thought about that before. I'm like, I'm a comedian. My job is to make people laugh to the best of my ability without upsetting anyone. Now I've got an option to steer a huge conversation at a time when the conversation is really weird and sort of getting a bit dangerous. I get to steer it back to normality. And because I always say this, if I was a baker, and I'm transgender and I was a baker, I'd just be a bloody good baker. I'd do my best to bake really good bread. I'm an entertainer. So my job is to be right up in people's faces, almost sharing your truth, which a lot of people just take as the opinion. A lot of people get their news from comedians, don't they? A lot of people get their opinions from comedians. So it's sort of my job to fill that in. So it's a really weird situation where me doing that to the best of my ability effectively is changing the course of how people feel about a certain issue. Bakers and pilots and, you know, solicitors don't have to worry about that. But when you're in the arts, people are looking at us for their opinions. All of this is to say that I feel now, I love the responsibility that the stuff I'm saying and the image I'm giving out is affecting how people feel day to day about transgender people. That's really nice.
Do you feel up to it? Do you feel that is a phenomenal, you could see that as a huge burden. If all you want to do is make people laugh and you're used to performing to your fans and friends and family, and now suddenly you have this platform. The platform has kind of been, I'm not going to say it's entirely been thrust upon you. You were seeking it, but fucking hell, it delivered. It's like a hose. Do you know what I mean? It's like, why isn't this hose working? And you look down at it and wham.
It's always a kink in the way. That's also a good metaphor. Usually the reason a person's career isn't working is because they've got a secret kink they don't want anyone to know about.
that's very deep. Very, very deep. Very lovely.
I love the responsibility. You're right. It is like, I would like to have fun with my friends and my people, but nobody ever said we were actually supposed to be happy. I'm happy doing that bit. All the other really hard stuff, it's like, well, it's my job. And also, we're all going to die one day, so do a good job of what you do while you're here. I love it. It's when you intellectually acknowledge that life is short, people say it, well, like, oh, life is short. Life is short. When you actually go, oh shit, life is short, and you feel it, everything becomes really easy. So I'm like, well, I'm only going to have to do this for another 60 years and then I'll be dead. So I love it. I actually, I perform better if there's a lot of pressure on to perform well, because I'm working class. So our scrappiness is our superpower, isn't it? It's like, that's what we can summon that other people maybe can't, because they haven't been forged in the fire of adversity. This is all very flowery
very
language.
Good. Very fluent. Very, you know, you've articulated that in a very exciting and passionate kind of a way.
I have to stop talking like that because my comparisons to Russell Brand are already numerous and ubiquitous. So if I use all this superfluous rhetoric, that's why people say it. I swear that's why people think. Because I've got Russell's hair. You can't, obviously, this is an audio medium, but we are filming as well. I usually have a backcomb haircut. And if I also talk like him, it's like, I can't. It's my own fault to get those comparisons.
Your personality, although as kind of outre as Russell Brand's, is sufficiently different, and you're a woman and a trans woman to boot. Like, that's enough degrees of separation.
For you and I, that degree of separation, that makes sense as a degree of separation. For a lot of people, being transgender moves it back towards the original thing. That's the world that we live in. So I have a deep voice and we are about the same height, me and old Russ. Actually, Russ is like notoriously tall. I reckon he's probably got a few inches on me in all respects. But yeah, you're right. Being a woman is at least one degree of divergence away. And we have different, I suppose we have different values. I do literally talk about being Jesus.
You do share a kind of messianic quality. I mean, and we'll talk about the show a little bit, because one of the things that's so infectious about it, and it's all of the reviews have said this as well, is that your angle of I'm amazing is incredibly infectious. That joke about playing the piano where you go, I don't remember the line, but it's like, I've never done this before. And then you just kind of smash out. I don't have the vocabulary, but you are clearly incredible at it. And you go, wow, this is a piece of piss. Do you know what I mean? That kind of I'm amazing angle.
Thank you so much for saying that. But you're right. It's like, if the day that people believe me, or believe that I believe it, then it's over. The magic is gone. If people think that I think I'm amazing to the degree that I say that sure. I am, the fun is gone. It's obviously betraying an underlying sense of insecurity in other areas. I'm an artist because I'm a child of divorce. And I suspect that's true for most people in some way. Like, there's a million types of artists. So let's not generalize, but like when you've got a feedback loop of praise coming from two different parents that aren't friends themselves. You learn what the specific nuance of what attention you want from people, I suppose. I don't know. Like, this is all me figuring out in retrospect. But point is, I have a detriment. I'm on a negative of praise from my childhood, and I'm seeking it now. That's why I'm an artist. There has to be a reason why I brought this up.
No, I was talking about someone who hasn't seen you might sound now like, if they listen to this, they're going, well, that doesn't seem like a very attractive angle. It's an incredibly attractive angle.
Right.
Because it's coming from, I think this is the point you're making, it's coming, like, we know that you're not, it's not just a person standing there saying, I'm amazing. We know that it's forged in something.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And we live vicariously through that person. I am that person in that instance. So it's weird to talk about it in objectively, but I always like to, I use the royal we when I'm saying, like, you're watching me, i.e. we're watching me, and you were living vicariously through how much fun I'm having. That's how I like to talk about it. But to speak to something you said earlier that is relevant, I did have a couple of days when it did feel like I was maybe given a 7 out of 10 performance, which I'll take on most days. That's fine. I gave a 7 out of 10 to the Times and they gave me a 4-star, and I have been kicking myself all for months. And then my friend was like, it's a 4-star in the Times, you bellend, just calm down. The reason I had given a couple of 7 out of 10 performances is because I suddenly started to believe the hype of the character of being amazing, and everything was going so amazing that I came on and it wasn't coming from a place of gratitude anymore. It was a slam dunk, hey guys, you're welcome, I'm here. That could still be funny if the attitude was right, but my attitude for 2 days was oh, people are really enjoying this hype, I should lean into the hype. Completely changes the magic. So a Goulier trained clown told me that the reason why you're feeling that way is because clowns come at things from underneath. Everything is on the clown and they are the fool, and they receive and they're very grateful for every moment. And you never come at anything from above. Never walk into a room ready to slam dunk the audience. Like, you've still got to be receiving their gratitude and make it for them. And it changed everything. It's the lessons you learn at Fringe as a comedian is such a pressure cooker. If you're open and receptive to receiving and changing, you come out of it 10 years improved, like by any other respects. It's so amazing. So that stays with me forever. I'm about to do the biggest shows of my career. And the moment before I go on, I'm an atheist, but I have to thank something. So just thanking the audience, maybe literally, I don't know, you know, like in comedians, we introduce ourselves a lot. Some people choose not to do that, but maybe, yeah, thanking them in my own little special way before I go on reminds me that it's for them. And I am a vicarious object for them to live through. And we like to feel good about ourselves, but we also like to feel like we're good people, I guess, and grateful. And I've got to show that. Also, I've got to be a bloody... what's the word? Example, don't I? I've got to be a really good example of a transgender person. I don't just get to be a comedian. I have to be really gracious and virtuous and nice, which is not funny at all.
But I think those things dovetail. The idea of, like, humility as a clown and graciousness as a representative. Presumably, yeah. There's a relationship between those.
Yeah, but... the character of, I don't know, there's a worthiness that people are so savvy to now that feels forced. And I don't want to incorporate gratitude into my set to the point where if I'm not feeling it that night, I have to fake it because that would be even worse. Luckily, I'm very, very grateful for everything that's going on. But you do get days where, just like I've been talking about, if people are arguing over money and money was never a big part of the problem, there's a couple of hours a day, I'm like, well, this isn't fun anymore. What the hell?
Yeah.
Like money is, you need... not having money is awful and having loads of money is awful. It's really, really bad. I haven't even got it yet. Those settlements, even by the time this goes out, those settlements probably won't be in from Fringe and beyond. But people are already spending it for me or deciding that it's theirs. It's really horrible. Like, but I'm overselling it. I'm having a really nice time. And I also don't care about it.
So this is Jordan. A delight. I'm so excited. I'm so pleased to be back. I really needed the break. And we've got episodes in the can now with Jordan Gray, Lauren Patterson, Glenn Moore, Grace Petrie and Esther Manito. Everyone a fantastic act. Every episode a banger. So I am full of the joys, as you can no doubt hear. And very, very excited to be speaking to Jordan and... also because Jordan is another person who whose career is going off, who has some relationship to this podcast. And I used to, out of, I don't know what sort of Britishness, delete the bits where people on the episodes would go, hey, you know, this podcast is really important to me. I'm so glad to be here. And I'd go, oh, you, and then delete that bit because I didn't want it to be like I'm broadcasting and showing off. But that's what media is, isn't it? So I think if we accept that all of us have the hubris to be stand-up comedians in the first place, maybe I'll start leaving that stuff in a little more, because perhaps one of the missteps I've made along the way, for which I very warmly and kindly forgive my previous self, is hiding my light under a bushel. Well, no more. Yeah, okay, probably a bit more. So more from Jordan soon. We are going to find out more in the second section of this episode. Well, let me look at the notes. Do you listen? Do you even listen to this bit? We're going to find out about... Oh, OK, so there's some great chat about stand-up coming up. And one of the things, as you will hear, that I said to people to recommend the show when I saw it very early on at the Fringe, oh, I was there first, is among the first-ish several years in, was the example I would give is she's got original angles on Batman. And that is, as a stand-up comic, if you can have an original angle on something as careworn as the concept of Batman, then my hat is off to you. So we're going to find out all about that. And remember, go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders for ad-free episodes, for all the extra content, including 25 minutes of extras from this one, in which we find out about the transferable skills a comic can bring to script writing. Highly recommend that. Really, really good. She is a very smart cookie indeed. Can a cookie be smart? Every time I say smart cookie, I find myself going, that's not the thing, but you can't be a sharp cookie, can you? Who knows? Remember, go to jordangraylive.co.uk to get tickets for Jordan Live at the London Palladium on the 28th of October. And that is going to be a gig to remind people that you... To reminisce about and to say, I went to that one. Incidentally, before we go back in, last thing, this is an non-spawn con. This is an unpaid ad for the brilliant Steve Best. Very funny comedian, phenomenal photographer. If you go to stevebest.com, you can pre-order his incredible, glorious new... It's one of those, you see an image of the book, and you just go, I want to eat that book. The edible book, Comedians... which is full of fabulous, fabulous photographs of comics in little kind of pre-gig and mid-gig and backstage kind of moments. And it's just a glorious kind of... I don't mean to insult it by calling it a coffee table book. It's not going to fit on your shelf. So go to stevebest.com. And if you mention ComComPod at checkout when you pre-order, then you have the chance. You go in a draw to win a print, which you can see at stevebest.com/blurry-bikes. And it's just a glorious backstage print with a load of famos in it. Perfect moment, and it's great, and the RRP on that is £800, so you can win that actual print, and you can go to draw to win it if you mention ComComPod at checkout when you go to stevebest.com to pre-order the glorious photo book Comedians. Non-spawn con ends. Let's get back to Jordan.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row, dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This is a slight tangent, but I'm interested. Do you have a kind of a stay sane kit? Do you have a toolkit for things like that where you're like, oh, if this is going off in the way that it appears to be, and if we are, you know, if this could be the real start of something that is absolutely massive, in the, like to use the example of Tim Minchin, you know, yeah. Just you could be colossal. Do you have a, are you kind of starting to build, or do you already have a toolkit of ways of looking after yourself within that?
That's such a lovely question. I'm about to say something very pretentious, and I've only recently come to realize how true it is, and it's all right to say it. And I was so ashamed of saying it for so long. The reason I'm not going to go mad is because I'm fucking mad. I'm just mad, and it's all right to be a bit mad. I was ill for a really long time, very, very ill for a long time in that respect. My brain wasn't working properly. But it gave me loads of time to put things in place and mechanisms in place to like, I don't have a high functioning, popular, like sensationalized mental illness or anything like that. Those sound awful. And those people have my heart goes out to those people. But my brain doesn't work normally, and I'm really sick of pretending that it does. Like now I don't have to. It's like everything's going to be so mad. There's Russell used to say some lovely stuff, Russell Brand, about if he wasn't famous, his haircut would just look like a mental illness. And I love that line. That's so good. I love that I get to be a mad slob now. I just get to wear my jeans and trainers around, and nobody's telling me that, well, those aren't very feminine anymore, you should maybe look into some nicer clothes and wear more makeup. I'm like, do whatever the fuck I want. Look, everyone's loving it, everyone's having a really nice time, just leave me alone. I don't have to I get to jump over a lot of I get to jump the queue in a lot of respects, and I also don't have to hold myself to as high a standard anymore in terms of I don't like making people feel uncomfortable. So I think what it is mania. I have a little bit of a manic side, not the depression bit. I don't get sad. I just get a bit too excited about stuff and do really silly things, like take my clothes off and run around. Again, if I wasn't popular, that'd be seen as problematic. But now people seem to love it. It seems to have garnered a lot of stars in the old tabloids, me getting nude and running around.
It's interesting just on that to imagine a version of, and this kind of feeds into that idea of like, I don't get sad. I assume you don't mean you don't ever get sad, but what you're talking about is you don't suffer from the downside of the mania that a lot of people do. Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't
I'm just
feel
wondering,
like, dip. Yeah.
Like, had you taken that show to Edinburgh and just had a tough time? I mean, it was a very small shipping container type venue, and had the reviewers just not come, the PR hadn't worked, and word didn't get out, and you did that show to 20 people a night, and it was a struggle. Do you imagine, like, how do you imagine you would feel in terms of your, like, that parallel universe? Like, would you be out of it thinking, crack on, next thing, how do I improve it? How do I change? Or would you be feeling like, holy shit, I put everything into that?
Yeah, I would feel cynical and skeptical, as we all do, and that, like, why didn't it work? Then you get over that, because the answer is the world isn't fair. That's fine. This me getting this success isn't an example of the universe being fair. It's a lightning rod. I won the lottery. I put loads into it. It's not like There is a million incredible comics toiling away in obscurity right now that could and probably should have been standing where I stood when the lightning rod hit. I did put a lot of work in, and so I feel rewarded, but I don't believe in a karmic like rebalancing. I don't think I worked hard enough to get the amount of fame I got. I still won the lottery. So I would come out of it, I would compartmentalize and I would rationalize it that life's just not fair. Keep going. This is what I chose to do. I love that I don't have to worry about that for at least a little while. that's a real joy. My shoulders haven't felt tight for 7 weeks. Like it just as soon as that Guardian came through on the third day, I was like, oh, right. Oh, wow. Okay. So now we can, all this energy that I've been putting into keeping my head above water, we can use that to elevate us to an incredible place. The stuff we're talking about now is, I'm taking it around the world is the thing. Not that's not wishful thinking. There's dates, there's money and dates have exchanged. The show's is about to go around the world. My face is going to be on lots of rectangles. Which is nice.
It's one of the best shapes.
Yeah. I'll tell you what I love. I love a rectangle with a beveled edge, Stu. Those are the best kind.
So how much can you tell? What's the embargo thing that we can talk about now? Because you've checked
the dates.
I'm
so glad I can tell you. I'm genuinely not allowed to talk about it with anyone, and now I get to talk. So I can tell you now, because it'll be coming out after the embargo, that Jordan Gray, Is It a Bird, is coming to the London Palladium on the 28th of October, and with a view to doing very well. They've got a feeling it's going to sell out, if not very, very fast. So that's very, very cool. Soho Theatre that I'm doing for 2 weeks is already sold out. That's done. And then we're taking it to bloody Melbourne and Montreal and like all the comedy festivals, you know. Broadway offered 5 offers from Broadway to take the show to Broadway. So we just have Broadway's just in the bag. It's just where we.
I don't even know about Broadway. What like
what?
There's loads of theaters, and five people are offering. Broadway venues are going. You should come to us.
Programmers.
So my instinct as a person who's been to Edinburgh a lot of times makes me think, oh, okay, so some of them will be saying, hey, you should come to us because we're biggest and you'll make most money. And some will be saying, you should come to us because we've got all the cachet. And you then have to make decisions about which one to take. Is it that kind of sphere of...
That's exactly it. That's very astute. And also there's a conversation about, well, what if we start at off Broadway, even though we've had Broadway offered, and then we retro engineer the story of what it started off Broadway. Look how popular it's become. And it's got itself a Broadway venue. I'm giving you all the Hollywood secrets here.
Check all of this with your agent, please, because I don't want to screw it up for you because you've been so candid about it. But
I like the story is important, but being self-aware of that story, the story behind the story, and people's savviness is so high nowadays. I think people kind of appreciate that. Like I did The Voice and I was the first trans person on it. It's the first person that didn't get a turn and then got brought back. And in real time, it's just all very exciting. But in retrospect, it's a Cinderella story. It's a classic story that's engineered. I'll go on record as saying it's engineered. I don't know that for sure.
Just engineered by them, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't really know about The Voice. I've seen some clips and you've got a breathtaking voice. It's really funny having seen you use your incredible voice and piano skills to comic effect. It's very weird seeing you then play it straight because I'm like, why are you doing this, Jordan? as a person, I'm not like a pop music fan. That's not my genre. I've never watched The Voice. I don't kind of get it. But it is really interesting to go, oh, it's like you've got all those skills, but you're not doing the thing with them that you do.
I did music for 10 years and I get on a daily basis now. It dipped off for a bit. And then when Edinburgh started again, people say, I love your comedy, but I wish you'd do the music. And that for them, that is a beautiful compliment. And for me, that's just a twist of the knife in my heart. It's like the thing that you've chosen. It's like someone saying to Michael Jordan, you know, you're shit at baseball. You're so shit. Like, this is what he wanted to do. Like, leave him alone. I am going to bring out some more music, but once you've done comedy, everything becomes ironic and everything's layered in 7 layers of irony. I can't now sit down and sing a love song earnestly that doesn't have some clever semantic field or some funny story. Like, I can listen now to like Call Me Out by Paul Simon. And I'm like, oh, okay. That for me is, that's right on the money of, that's a serious piece of music, but there's so many little witty schisms and whimsy in there that it's like, okay, it's not jokes. Like, I can listen to now to like Eminem or rap because it's jokes. It's a million jokes, very cleverly layered jokes, goes to some dark places, but it's a lot of wittiness. I can enjoy that music now. I can't just listen to pure love songs. And that's a real shame. The muse, whatever it is, the muse that sits on your shoulder. I brought out a single after The Voice and it was so shit. And I'm on record as saying that. So I'm sorry to anyone that was involved because like you all did a good job, but what we made was so homogenous and bland that muse just flew away. The little muse that's on my shoulder. And I looked, I was like, oh shit. I've completely sold out. And it broke my heart. I don't know when it's going to come back.
You saw pop music from the inside. You mean the blandness, the team of people making that bland little kind of bubble.
Yeah.
That's what chased the muse away. Or that's what chased your love for pop music away.
It was very expensive. And my little working class brain was like, oh, you spend money because the quality will improve. And yeah, the sound gets better, but the quality of the music becomes paint by numbers. And it was something I've never listened to in a million years. I wouldn't listen to it. That's got to tell you something. Yeah. It's like, I can't do that for the rest of my life. Whereas I can listen to my own jokes still make me laugh, which is a great sign because I can't remember who said it. I think it was like Chris Rock on a podcast was like, you should not have a single joke in your set that didn't make you laugh when you first thought of it.
Yeah.
At least for a bit.
Yeah.
I mean, you lose that magic. You can't expect to be tickled by it every time. You're not going to be surprised by it. But yeah, I can still enjoy my own music. I still enjoy my own comedy. And that means, that means it's probably got a good shelf life for me to keep, say, excited about.
It's arguably the only criterion, isn't it? It's like, if it makes you laugh, it's so easy to forget that because I think as comics, you're kind of, when you're writing, there are phases of writing where you're like, Christ, I need something. Or I passionately want to say a thing, but I don't know how to say it in a funny way. And when you work it out and you go, oh, it's that joke, that moment is such a relief, and then you forget it. I mean, I've mentioned on the podcast before that I had a lovely experience, I don't know how long ago it was, in the last year or so, where Spotify Shuffle played me an old bit of mine from an album that's on Spotify, I'd forgotten the ending. So I listened to it not knowing where it was going, and I laughed out loud. I'm like, well, there we
that's
go.
The
I mean,
joy.
The thing is, like, that is, it's like a 5-star review from yourself. In a way that is, I mean, incredibly mawkish and pretentious and sort of self-satisfied, I suppose. It can't not be. But at the same time, what are you doing it for, if not to kind of satisfy your own sense of humour?
If you are to be reminded that you are your own demographic, it must be a joyful experience. That's what I had in music was the polar opposite. I found out I wasn't my own target demographic, which is very sad. So comedy allows us to reconnect with, ourselves. That lovely thing of learning that casting a broad net is fine if that's what you're going for, but also if you're passionate and dedicated enough and you're happy with the niche that you filled, you'll find your audience and you'll build it, and those people will be more dedicated than ever. The people that love Jeff Buckley more than anything else in the world, and the rest of the world has never heard of him. But his fans, he's well known, but he's not held up as the superstar he should be. I think he's a living angel. I'm not immune to this hero worship of Jeff Buckley because it's so him and so uniquely him that if you hit it and you land and it hits you, it's like seeing a mirror image of your soul rather than a retro-engineered sort of wide net that's being cast at you to try and get you to come and listen. You feel like you discover Jeff Buckley. And I feel that way about a lot of comedians. Maria Bamford is maybe my favorite comedian of all time, and she's an incredibly singular comedian. She's been through a lot of trouble in her life, and that's forged probably her opinions of staying true to the course and being who she is rather than trying to lose your identity by being homogenous. Wow, that just came out of nowhere. I've never even thought about that before. If you're just listening, listeners, she just gave me the little chef's kiss finger, which I will cherish forever. So Maria Bamford and Jeff Buckley, that's my team. We have chatted about how I can walk out and say I'm amazing and nobody actually believes me. Nobody thinks I'm arrogant. They can see straight away that that's underpinned by self-doubt, like we all are. Do you have a similar experience because you seem so put together and so slick as a comedian? Slick is a great word. I hope it's a compliment that it is. You're so slick. Do you ever feel like people mistake that for arrogance, or do you think that people can see your sort of the skittishness that underpins most of your behaviour? So,
great question. Long question. Give me a second. Yes. Interesting that you should say slick. Slick was the bane of my life for about 5 years.
That's why I was conscious of that.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Thank you. Every review I had would say I was slick, and it was something I was fighting against for a long time. And I think I'm a lot less slick now. And what I hope I'm doing now is using the if you say instead of slickness, if you say the confidence that I inspire in people, like the other nice thing that people say all the time is as soon as this guy walks on stage, you think, oh, this is going to be fine. So if call it that-ness, whatever it is, what I hope I'm doing now is using that to be really honest and really open and really and try and be a bit more challenging about, for example, the environment and climate change and eco dread. And I've always tried to talk about anxiety but I have found it a challenge because I think I don't come across like someone who suffers from anxiety. And so it's very difficult to talk to the audience about the anxiety I feel because it breaks the contract that I have unwittingly formed with them. I walk on and my presence says, you're all right, I'm all right, this is going to be fine. And if I go, I find myself screaming with rage in my car, that's a hard sell. And instead of going, tell us about that broken, interesting person, they go, oh shit, are you all right? Because they like me so much.
It's such a burden for you to carry. It really is. That's not fair. Like, I don't think I've ever had to worry about something like that. I guess if you're a degree removed from like straight white man, the otherness of that means that you've got almost got license to go into deeper places than this is. I'm saying all of this unironically. This isn't a bit. I'm not doing a joke. Like straight white men have to that the taking ownership of any sort of otherness, any sort of sense of anxiety or divergent from a perfectly neurotypical brain is like it's a bigger conversation for you. I don't know. I feel like I've got license to go deeper than you would have, especially if your style and the slickness that you've had attributed to you. That seems unfair to me that you would feel like you have to maintain that. It's a well-crafted facade in a good way. Cause of course we don't walk around telling jokes at that intensity and frequency so well-crafted in conversation. So of course it's a facade. So for you to have to hold that up, I'm literally sometimes when I run out and I'm like, this is amazing. When I say I'm amazing, that's different. But when I run out and go, this is amazing, I'm just saying it because it's real. It's true. Yeah. I get to walk out and be so vulnerable with my feelings that it feels like you don't get to do that.
I haven't cracked how to do it. There are plenty of straight white guy comedians who have cracked how to do that. But I've always struggled with that. So that's my answer to your question is, I have always struggled with specifically that, with showing vulnerability. Like I want to show vulnerability. At the same time, I'm very inhibited in a way that you are not. I absolutely love your lack of inhibition in all respects. That's part of the thrill ride of the show is look at this incredibly uninhibited woman just telling us everything. I'm very inhibited because I always say, like, there's a thing I think with someone like Fern Brady, you sort of go, Fern will just fucking tell the truth. She'll just say the world as she sees it. And I'm sorry, I feel like I've used her as an example of this before. So apologies, Fern, if I keep talking about it. But, I think like, well, I can't tell the world how I really feel about my relationship with my mum because it'll get back to her because she's still alive and she'll be terribly upset. And I don't want to upset everybody because one of my foundational premises, to use the phrase of Iván Aristegueta, a fabulous Venezuelan comic now in Australia, who is absolutely worth seeking out his episode of this podcast. It's brilliant. He talks about comics having foundational premises. And one of the foundations of my life is that I just want everything to be okay. That's why I'm charming. That's why I make people feel good with my presence, because I passionately want them all to be okay. Even the dicks. Do you know what I mean? I just want everyone to be okay. And that will be, I'm not a child of divorce. They divorced when I was an adult and I'd already made myself. But I am a child of, this is an awkward tension and I think I can fix it. You know, that's one of my big kind of things.
I can certainly relate to the idea of not wanting to upset anybody. That's a big part of it. I would never make anybody feel uncomfortable, and I also never trip anybody up in the show. I'm very conscious that there's not a single bit of the show that makes you feel bad for not knowing a piece of information. You might feel silly or feel, oh, I can't believe I thought that, but there's no, I don't want to ever trip anybody up or upset anybody. I think the difference is I have such a low threshold for like, it's like, to say subhuman intelligence is a far too strong of a phrase, but I have a cutoff point for there's a certain level of intelligence where I'm like, well, then we're a different we're a different species, so like I'm just gonna entertain my that threshold is it's not about book smarts. It's not, yeah, I'm working class. I grew up just like everybody else. I think it's like an emotional intelligence below a certain amount. If you're not willing to take ownership of your emotional intelligence as a human, I'm happy to write you off as, okay, they are irredeemable and unsavable. And I don't mind those people being upset by the show. People that come with an open mind of any, intelligence is maybe the wrong word, an open-mindedness of any level. I never want to make those people, I want to reward those people for being open-minded. I never want to upset anybody with an open mind. If your mind is fully closed, then that's fine. And maybe you have your brackets even wider. You don't want to upset those people either. You just don't want to upset anyone.
Yes, already, before you even brought that back to me, I was like, yeah, but the people's minds are openable. And if people have closed minds, they can be saved. You know what I mean? You can open their minds.
Yeah, I'm an evangelical comedian.
Yeah, I don't say saved as a very eggy.
It's good. It's very true.
You know, but you...
I don't have the skill set to open those brains, no. But the brains that are... I'll take anybody on the fence... I will help you get off that fence, my friend. But if you're at a point where anything will entrench you in your belief, I think it's pathological. There's really a very small amount of people whose minds are truly, truly closed, truly closed. And it's usually a fear-based thing that's pathological, and that's fine. I shouldn't be so harsh on those people, really.
A lot of a criticism that is often levelled at people who have a decent understanding of social justice, and you know, or I mean, I'd even call it social justice is kind of pejorative, but people who are broadly speaking good people, as I would see them, a kind of criticism levelled at that is that you're preaching to the choir. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, is Nish Kumar changing anyone's mind, or is he simply? I know that not that this is simple in itself, but. Is he rallying people who already agree with him? Having said that, I've clipped this from a review and not even had the decency to write down the name of the reviewer. I cannot attribute this, but...
Imagine how pretentious it would be if I could tell you the name of the reviewer.
Oh, come on. You shout out the name of the reviewer or the publication when you get to it. We'll do. That is a really fun format game. Not for this podcast, but for something. At what point can you recognise this reviewer? And this person says, a friend told me that her mum went into Is It a Bird with scepticism towards trans issues, but left understanding for the first time what the community actually goes through. It would be easy to think that Gray's work is light-hearted, crass and fun, because it is, but it can and will change opinions and lives.
That's so wonderful. That feels like, if I was to hazard a guess, that sounds like The Independent.
I didn't write it down. I've got no idea.
Oh, you didn't write it down. The Independent went with a quote of how the show will change lives, which was so that was a tearjerker of a moment for me as well, because then it becomes more than comedy. Suddenly I'm changing.
Oh, shit. You've got all these responsibilities. You've got to, if you can change lives, that's great power. As you know, as a superhero fan, that's a great responsibility.
That semantic field of, I'm so glad you brought that up. I'm walking around Edinburgh. It's such a bubble. The way I G myself up is I listen to the soundtrack from Spider-Man and Spider-Man 2. Not just the orchestral scores, but the bands from the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man films. The show, there's a through line about Batman. So every time I saw a picture of a bat or a Batman, I'm like, oh, that's for me.
Yes.
And then it really doesn't help that level of psychosis. And I do call it a psychosis because it truly is a psychosis. For then someone to say, this show will change lives. I'm like, wow. I must actually be changing into a caped crusader. I was only a few reviews like that from donning a cape and trying to save lives on the cobbled streets of Edinburgh over nighttime during August. It's really hard to, because the show's all, that's the whole field of the show. The whole thing is about superheroes. I'm there on the poster with a cape and I'm flying, and if I was pulling a silly face, then the whole show is ruined in that picture, because it's like the seriousness of being a superhero doesn't fight against the jokes and the humor of the show. But when people start to talk about it in such high regard, it's that the line blurs so quickly of this show is, you know, this, like they say, changing people's lives, saving people from like horrible opinions and stuff. It was a weird blur for the month for me to walk around feeling like I was, I might as well be wearing a cape.
This show will save a busload of children from falling off a bridge.
This show will cast tensile steel webs across buildings and save a runaway train full of people before a robot octopus man. But I think you've pushed the metaphor too far.
One of the things that I was so excited to see in the show, and we haven't even talked about this at all. We talked a lot about the experience of the explosive show and the ramifications of that. The thing I would say to people for the 2 or 3 days after I saw it, at which point I no longer needed to say anything to people. The thing I would say to people is, oh my God, she's so funny. It's so infectious. The whole vibe, we'd always mention that, I'm just trying to think back to the conversations I had. I would say the whole vibe is I'm amazing and it really works. And it's just this incredibly kind of powerful, uplifting thing. But I tell you what, there's some fucking good stand up in there as well. And the example,
thank you so much.
The example I would give is there. I've got a friend called Asaf who is, he's a street performer and who I often see in Edinburgh. And he's quite sceptical about stand-up. He gets recommendations from me. We've got a running joke where instead of Siri, when I left the festival, they would record voice memos and say, hey, Stewie, what should I see at 8 o'clock? So I'd be like their show recommender. Maybe I could monetize that or do it for next year.
Yeah.
The thing I said to Asaf, who's a superhero fan as well, I said, she's got original angles on Batman. And he was like, what? And I said, yeah. You know Batman who we love and everyone knows it. Well, you know, people like he and I know everything about. And we've heard done to death from every angle comically. She's got original angles on Batman. And he was like, I'm going to fucking see that show. So
that's a huge compliment. That from you specifically and knowing your love of Batman. That's wonderful. Thank you. Those sections, all three sections of the show, I treat it like three sections of stand-up because it's four songs, stand-up in between. All three of them were the second tier of nicheness of my material. I didn't want to go in too broad. I wanted to talk about stuff I really cared about. And so there was times when that stuff is just bombing over and over and over again because I haven't hit the reason why. I know why it's funny, but I haven't hit it yet. All the dog section, the Batman section, and the baby section. All three of those were struggling for so long, and I'm glad because it means that they've been forged properly.
Yeah.
So to hear that is a huge compliment. Thank you.
So to hear, you're welcome, and you deserve it. And those, tell me about tell me about those bits failing. Do you mean that when you, because it's clear that like, it felt to me like you had gone into clubs with no keyboard and just done those stand-up bits
yeah.
and gone, this is stand-up, yeah, yeah. And I don't have a keyboard to save me at the end. The stand-up has to work. Is that what you did?
That's it, 100%. Because you can even get the good graces of people on board for a song, and then they can smile their way through a loose Batman bit because there's another song coming. You're right, it was. I don't want to be a musical comedian. I want to be known as a comedian that has a party trick that happens to be these Minchin-esque songs. Mm. So I'm really happy that's the kind of the vibe that I get. I love that people would compare me. I imagine being upset being compared to Tim Minchin or Bo Burnham. It's incredible. But I like that I'm thought of as a stand-up that will wheel out a piano occasionally.
I'm sorry, I interrupted what was probably your answer to readdress the question. Yeah. When those Batman bits weren't working, like what works about the Batman bit in the scope of the show is that it's not just about Batman. But the jokes themselves, you could carve out and make a 15-second reel and bang, that's a viral Batman joke because it's a very funny, very like staring us in the face, how did no one think of that before kind of observation. Did you find when those didn't work, did you ever risk losing faith in them?
Yeah, and I realised why they weren't working. The first time I said that the first time I basically pointed out that Batman's entire life is based on a lie because he's afraid of bats, so he dresses like a bat to scare people. Why on earth would he think that would extend to other people? It got a huge laugh because it's the first time I'd said it and I was really excited about it. The reason why it started to not work and I lost faith was because you can't just say that without having people need to know what my opinion of that is. So I can't just relay the information and say, you know, Batman, have you noticed that Batman's whole thing? So Batman dresses like a bat in the comic books. It has to be me annoyed at how Batman gets away with this, whereas I can't wear a dress without getting hassled. And yet the whole world has no problem with Bruce Wayne. He calls himself a Batman and he dresses like a bat. And everyone goes, oh, I can't wait to see another movie worth of that. I put on some earrings and call myself a woman. Oh, come on now. That's a little bit too much.
Do you think, and this is from a mystery person who asked not to be identified, do you think that cis comedians who would call themselves trans allies but work with openly transphobic comedians need to be held accountable, or is it just a job? Ooh, quick fire that.
It's not just a job. It is a responsibility, but there is no. The fact that they're in that same space is enough. The fact that they're working in that same space to me says that the conversation is not over yet. They're keeping the conversation alive. No, I think Ricky Gervais, Dave Chappelle are master craftsmen. I think one of them's got a bit lazy and one of them's got a bit righteous, but they're still master craftsmen and the conversation is still going. So let's give them a chance to steer things back in the right direction.
That's a fantastic answer. That's a very generous answer. Good for you. This is Jesse Johnson. Quick fire, if you please. Given the UK has a reputation for trans hostility from the right and left, does she feel the role of trans figurehead is in some way being foisted upon her? We've covered that, I think. Does she feel pressured to represent a group that are not a monolith, to educate cis audiences or to get it right whenever she does so? I don't know about you. For me, I think the best bit of that is, does she feel pressured to represent a group that are not a monolith?
I do feel pressured, and I always point out that I am not representative of all of us. I'm one of us. I'm doing my bloody best. Thanks for your support. I'm trying to get it right. I am just a person that has tits and a penis, and that affords me a certain amount of leverage to be able to steer the conversation. But we are all different, and that's the best thing about us, is that we're all different.
There is a very amusing visual picture to be drawn from having leverage to steer a conversation with a penis. I'm going to ask you if you're happy. Are you happy, Jordan?
Yeah. Yeah, that should have been much more quickfire than it was, but I had to think about it. I'm happy with the work. There are a lot of pangs of sadness that come from the ramifications of basically, as comedians, we spend our entire lives giving ourselves all the tools we need to become successful. Once you sort of get a taste of success, you realize your toolkit is redundant and useless because it's not about getting there anymore. You're there. What do you do? So the only way I've been able to survive is to put ever more ridiculous goalposts, move the goalposts so far away from myself. And they're reaching to the points of megalomania now. So I'm happy. I am happy. Yeah, thank you for asking.
So that was Jordan Gray, and I am really looking forward to the 5 years on chat. I mean, never know. You never know. It happened with Nigel Young. It was a 6 months on chat. But let's imagine that Jordan is going to return to the show, as I hope she will, in years to come, and look back on this moment, and we'll get some more kind of insight on kind of like a retrospective. Like, it's so fascinating to go, this right now, this is the moment. This is the kind of star exploding moment. So what a joy. And thank you so much to Jordan for making time for me. I know that she's we had to put more faffing around and fitting it in than usual into this, because of course she's just doing a bajillion meetings a day, and good luck to her. So that is that. I will post Amble at you in just a second, but you can follow Jordan on Twitter and Instagram at @talldarkfriend. You can go to linktree.com/Stuart Goldsmith to get all of my links, or visit stuartgoldsmith.com to find out everything I'm up to, including all my Clever Clog stuff on resilience, which is going great guns. Thanks for asking. Go to comedianscomedian.com to find out more about the pod. The website is shonky because it was designed beautifully and I ruined it because I cannot make WordPress work for the life of me. So hopefully by the time you hear this, or at least by the end of the year, I will have transferred that website with the help of expert web wrangler James Hingley. I will have transferred it to Wix, in which case I can then press all the buttons myself and it will look a damn sight nicer. Please, 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 one day will this work, because I've driven that website into the ground, and it's go to comedianscomedian.com and just see how much I've ruined it. Like, I'm the classic example of a client that's like, everything is most important, everything must go at the top. You might get a laugh out of that, but while you're there, why not go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders and join up and sign up and then help me pay for my new website. All right. You can follow me at ComComPod on Twitter, or at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy on Instagram, or Chinese malware site TikTok. But I do not recommend you use that. If you are on it, please follow me, but don't go on it if you can avoid it. All right. So that is that. Thank you to Nathan. Producer Nathan for getting on the ones and twos. I was going to say, why would I say that? Thank you to Jordan for coming on the show. Thank you to Jordan's management for letting her record this interview in their office. Thank you to Moz for the logging, and Rob Smouten did the music, and Asher Trelevin invented the title of this podcast 10 years ago. And I think that's all the people I have to thank for now. So, post-amble in a sec. Bye for now. Goodbye forever. So one of the things I've been up to recently is building a pipeline. Shall I tell you about the pipeline, or shall I finish the pipeline and then tell you about it? It's where you get a big, I'm using an app called Scapple, where you basically, it's like, it's the online equivalent of a great big corkboard with bits of red string connecting things together. And what you do with the pipeline is you go, okay, if someone discovers me through Instagram, what is the most efficient way of them getting to know all the other stuff I do and incentivizing them to find out about it? And if someone discovers me through the pod, what is you, what you yourself may have experienced the pipeline. In fact, you are this. If you're listening to this, then how can I incentivize you to go, hey, this conversation is interesting. I wonder if there are more like them. What's the next bit of the path? Is it subscribing to the podcast? Is it joining the mailing list? Is it joining, following the YouTube channel and subscribing to that? What's the thing? So I'm trying to, I've drawn a big picture of it on Scapple, and I've nearly used up the free subscription, so I better get on with it. And just trying to work that out and seeing it in front of me is bananas. It's so complicated, and all of the things could join to all of the other things. So this is one of those situations where what I should really be doing is telling you to, I should be, do you know what I mean, it should be like a domino rally. What is the name for those in other countries? Because I had a bit of material about a domino rally once, and people outside of the UK didn't know what the fuck I was talking about. But it should be, I should be saying now, hey guys, join them, hey you, the specific listener, join the mailing list, because that would be good to do, because I don't pester you much, but I do. Like, someone recently thanked me for the sporadic nature of the emails, and when we're talking one every 6 weeks, sort of tops, really, meaning that they were always a nice surprise. So please join my surprise email list. Maybe I'll brand it as the surprise email list. Kind of takes the pressure off me to be consistent or coherent. But those are fun. I think they're actually fun, interesting, funny emails. They certainly, whenever I send one out, they get lots of responses. So I should be saying, hey, join the email list. And then at the bottom of every email, I should go, hey, join the ComCom Facebook group if you want to chat about comedy. And then there should be this whole journey. So welcome to your part of the journey. I'm hoping to refine it and make it slightly tidier and stop resisting marketing. Ultimately, we all want to resist marketing. This leads me into my reflections upon the Edinburgh Festival. We all want to resist marketing, but we all want our marketing to work. This year at Edinburgh, God, I was a grump for 4 or 5 days after coming back, because never before in my life, only once before in my life, have I left a perfectly functioning, exciting Edinburgh knowing that everyone was still up there. It was monumentally painful, and I'm not going to wang on about that. I had a great summer with my family. We had an amazing holiday together. We did loads of fun stuff. It was great. And now I'm about to go away for 2 days for work for the first time in ages. And I'm preemptively missing the kids and going all wobbly about it. So that is a very nice feeling, I suppose. And annoyingly, I missed the bin strike and the apparently 7-foot-high piles of bin bags that were in the street, which I didn't want to happen. But if it did happen, I didn't want to miss it. So I missed all the rats. That's a shame. But I had such a great time up there, and I saw loads of great stuff. Some of this I've already talked about in the Bianca Del Rio episode, so I won't go over it too much. But it was great. I love it. It also set my anxiety back a little while, a little bit, because I've been making. Oh, how deep do we go into this? Let's do surface for now. I am never ready for dressing room day. When you go into the Edinburgh Festival, one as a comic, when you go into any challenge, let's widen this out, any challenging time when you know you're going to be in a realm of critical appreciation, reviews and so on, and some people will win awards and what have you, you can steel yourself against it, and you can remind yourself, it's not a race, it's a dance, bracket Simon Munnery. It's, you know, you can remind yourself of all the things that you're going to hate. There's going to be reviews, and I've got to make sure I don't read them. I've got to make sure I don't read anyone else's. I've got to make sure I don't engage with that. Hey, there's going to be full houses and less full houses, and I've got to engage with the people who are in the room only. You prep it all. And then, of course, halfway through September, dressing room day happens, which is my name, which I hope catches on in my usual needy fashion. That's when all the people who are on this series of Live at the Apollo post photos of their name on the dressing room door, go, Live at the Apollo. And it always takes me by surprise, because I was ready for the Edinburgh and the management of the sort of personal distress. But that always takes me by surprise. And I only did a whip this year. Of course, I wasn't going to get recognised by that gang this year. And the people that are on it, God, they're all great and they all deserve their place. And there's some brilliant surprises and brilliant people who've been ready for ages who finally got it. All of that stuff's great. But just in terms of Muggins here and the decision in November last year to stop doing therapy because I felt so centered and like it had worked. I made decisions. I am now embodying those decisions. And I'm not going to gig much in September. I'm only going to do a week in Edinburgh because it's all part of an increasingly confident and happy master plan. And then this is the problem with being so all over the place, as my mental state often is, and being untethered and not just remembering from minute to minute what the plan was. I find myself in early September going, oh God, I'm not gigging. Have I retired? What's going on? No, Stuart, you decided not to gig much in September. Oh, right. But it really took for it all to kind of bubble over and me to go, I'm right back there. I'm where I was a few years ago. I'm just in the fucking tumble. I feel like a sock in the tumble dryer going stress and trauma and envy and guilt and, you know, sort of negative self-talk, all of those things. And then taking a deep breath. I'm not going to feel guilty about this admission. I had a little top up with my therapist, had a little MOT, and I highly recommend that. And as a result, went, oh, yes, it's fine. I made all these decisions and now I am acting on decisions I made a while ago. So isn't that nice to have acted on decisions that we all made a while ago and then bloody remember that that's what's going on? Here's what else is going on. I did a 10K, and thank you so much for those of you who donated. Loads of you. I think I made about 1,700 quid for Bristol Mind. That's really great. And they're very appreciative, as am I. So thank you very much if you sponsored me. I think there's got to be, I've never used the sort of website before, the Just Giving website. Presumably there's a way I can scan through it, read all the comments and then reply to people. I hope so. But thank you in this admittedly impersonal way if you donated. I didn't make as much of a fuss of it as I could. But I still made a bit of a fuss about it. And here's the thing. Here's my experience of running a 10K. If you are bored by running and you hate runners, please listen to this. Don't ignore this bit. The big secret is to talk to someone as you run round, right? The big secret in my case, I think what I did is I accidentally found out the best way for me to run, which is to be distracted. And then it turns out an official 10K, the official day when there's just thousands of people in the street and samba bands as you go past them and just stuff happening and the people running around you and the amusing moment when you notice, oh wow, this is really quiet, no one chats, because I chat when I run. I thought everyone chatted when they run. No, everyone's headphones on, head down, run, get through it. I was chatting away to me mates. Thank you to Jen and Steph who were with me on the run, and I just was comprehensively distracted and as a result breezed it. Like, it was fun. It was genuinely fun because it breezed it fair. I think it is fair. And then for the last 1,000 meters, I just went nuts. Someone gave me a jelly baby and it kicked in and I just tore through the last 1,000 meters. I ran further and faster than I've ever had in my life. And like fast for further. Like top speed for the last 1,000 meters, which I always remember is what Dave Longley says you should be able to do as a self-defense thing. You should be able to do top speed for a few minutes to get out of trub. So I just had this incredibly positive experience. And honestly, without being too much of a cock about it, I really felt like I could have kept going for at least another half an hour. So I think I'm going to sign up for the half, but I'm not going to do a marathon because then you get into training where your training runs are like 3 hours long. And who's got time for that? I haven't got that much chat in me. So I think I'm going to do a half. So I'll be back in touch with you for more sponsorship wiffle next year. But this is the point. The overarching point is that my wife was asking me that night whether I felt proud of it. She said, you must be really proud. And I didn't feel proud. I was pleased I'd done it, but I didn't feel proud because I felt I had cheated by having exactly the right mindset. And I think that's, oh, that was my headrest. Sorry. And I think that's a really great attitude, and an attitude that I would like to apply to all of the other numerous challenges that are constantly going on in my life, all the other work, all the unfinished projects. I cheated by doing all the right things at exactly the right time. And like, I did the training in advance. I'm up and running, all of those things. I cheated by doing all the things you're supposed to do. And this is not dissimilar to when I thought that I had pulled a fast one on the London congestion charge when it first came in. And I said to a friend of the podcast, Pete Dobbin, hey man, I'm cheating. Ah, ha, ha, ha. I said, I've beaten the system with the congestion charge. I only drive into central London on evenings and weekends when it's free. And he was like, yeah, that's what they want you to do. That's what you're supposed to do. So there we go. Cheating by having the correct mindset. This is my new watchword. I hope that you find a way to make the thing that you need to do easy and routine so that it becomes easy. So I'll speak more about that in future. But what? What was that? Yeah, because I said trub earlier on. Too much trub, you go to prison. That's my reminder. I've got to go and have an interesting call with someone about a thing. Goodbye forever. And I'll speak to you soon. Thanks for listening to this increasingly whiffly one. Ta-da. Oh, yeah, coming up soon. Next week, probably Lauren Patterson, then Grace Petrie, Glenn Moore, Esther Benito. Mwah, sumptuous.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.